Revelation chapter 15. We come to the third set of judgments. We had the seven seals, and then the seven trumpets, and now the seven bowls. And as you've observed, there's a certain similarity in each of these three sets. In fact, you'll notice that the similarities between the seven bowls and the seven trumpets is quite obvious. But there is one great difference, and that is that with these seven bowls of wrath that are poured out, you have angels coming out with bowls in their hand, but instead of custard or something like that in the bowls, it's wrath and all evil things, and they tip these things down onto the earth. Very graphic. But here you find there is no delay before the seventh judgment. In other words, we are reaching now the climax, and God's judgment is going to fall. The time has come. We've noticed also, as we've moved through these sets of judgments, that each set becomes more severe or more intense than the previous set. But before we look at these judgments, we have a picture of the triumphant Christians in the opening verses of chapter 15. The first verse tells us of the seven angels with the seven plagues coming out, and the second verse tells us that he sees a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name standing beside the sea of glass with harps in their hands. Here you have people who have conquered the beast. These are the Christians who refused to toe the party line for the satanic forces that we looked at last week. The same expression here as you have in chapters 2 and 3 concerning the overcomers in the church, in the letters to the churches. Those who triumphed through the testing times that were put before them. They may have suffered with their lives, but in God's view, they are conquerors. Their conquest of the beast is likened to the conquest of Egypt back in the time of Moses. And that's why it is that they sing the song of Moses in verse 3, because just as Moses, or just as God in the time of Moses, overthrew the oppressors and persecutors of God's people, so once again God's people have triumphed over their oppressors. Great and wonderful are thy deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. In the previous few chapters we saw how the people of the earth were impressed with the deeds of the first beast, Antichrist, and then the second beast, the false prophet. Here we find that God's people are impressed with God's deeds. Just and true are thy ways, O King of the ages. Who shall not fear and glorify thy name, O Lord? For thou alone art holy, and all nations come and worship thee. But then the scene shifts to this heavenly temple. Now, if you can cast your mind back to the end of chapter 11, at the end of the seven trumpets, we had the temple of God opened in heaven, and the Ark of the Covenant was seen within the temple. So we're going back now to pick up from that point. Remember that in each case we found that the seventh seal led onto the first of the trumpets, and now the seventh trumpet leads onto the first of the bowls. So we're back now to that scene in heaven. Verse 5. I looked, and the temple of the tent of witness in heaven was opened, and out of the temple came the seven angels with the seven plagues, robed in pure bright linen. Verse 7, one of the four living creatures gave the seven angels seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one could enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were ended. The significance of that seems to me to be that nobody could enter the temple to intercede. Nobody could gain any postponement of the judgment now. All the previous judgments, we've seen how God is holding back. The end is not yet, not yet. There's an interval before the final. But now, final judgment is about to fall. What the man is saying is this. All through history, there are judgments, there are persecutions, there are troubles. And God holds back the day of final intervention, extends his day of grace, if you like, that men might repent. But sooner or later the time will come when God says enough, and he holds back no longer. And that's what's happened here. It's no use praying any longer. God is now going to bring in the final crisis. So nobody can enter the temple to intercede on behalf of the world. Therefore you find in chapter 16 that the seven bowls are poured out one after the other right onto the seventh without any break. In the previous set of judgments, the trumpet judgments, we found that one third of the earth, of the sky, of the rivers, or whatever it was affected. In this case, now you find the effect upon these elements is total. This again is in keeping with the movement of the book, which is building up towards a climax. The world is getting worse and worse until finally God intervenes. It's an outpouring of God's wrath, and you notice the same four areas are dealt with in the first four judgments. The first angel in verse 2 poured his bowl upon the earth, and there were foul and evil sores upon men. The second angel poured his bowl upon the sea, and became like blood. The third angel poured his bowl upon the waters on the land. And then the fourth angel in verse 8 poured his bowl upon the sun and the heavenly bodies. Now those are the same four elements that the first four trumpets dealt with, but in each case here we find now that the judgment is total. These judgments are telling us what happens at any time during the whole of the world's history when judgments come upon men in these forms. You can go back to the very first century and you find that there were wars and there were plagues and there were famines and there were droughts and all sorts of evil things were happening. It has always been so, but when the final crisis comes, it will be total. The thing I want to draw your attention to is in verse 5. When the judgments are poured out upon the rivers and the fountains, they became blood, and I heard the angel of water say, "Just art thou in thy judgments, for thou art and wast, O Holy One. For men have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink." In other words, they get their deserts. What they've sown, they've now reaped. The punishment is proportionate to the crime they have committed. These are the people who have killed God's people, and now they themselves are getting punished proportionately. And in verse 7, I heard the altar cry, "Yes, Lord God the Almighty, true and just are thy judgments." And again, back to the altar. Every set of judgments that we've looked at has gone back to refer to the altar. Because if you remember back in the fifth seal judgment, back in chapter 6, the altar cried out, "How long, O God, holy and true, before you will judge and avenge our blood upon those who dwell upon the earth?" They were the martyred Christians praying to God. Now God has avenged their blood upon those who dwell upon the earth. Those who shed the blood of God's people now themselves are given blood to drink. In other words, they are punished by God. Whereupon the altar who first prayed that prayer, "How long before you're going to avenge our blood?" The altar says, "You have now answered our prayer. Yes, Lord, your judgments are indeed true and just." So there is another one of the underlying themes of the book of Revelation, that the judgments of God are set in motion by the prayers of God's people. God hears his people, and it's in defense of his people and in vindication of their righteousness that he pours out his judgment upon the evil ones. And that's another reason why it is that as Christians we are not to take the law into our own hands. Vengeance does not belong to us. We are to turn the other cheek. We are not to take the sword to fight against those who would persecute us, as we saw last week. But vengeance does belong to God, and he will repay. That is what the book of Revelation is telling us. You then come to the end of verse 9, and we find that people did not repent, neither did they give God glory, and that is pretty consistent. In spite of the judgments, men are hardened in their hearts, and they will not turn to God. You come then to the fifth outpouring in verse 10, and this angel pours his bowl on the throne of the beast. The beast is a reference to the first of the beasts that we saw in chapter 13. That is the beast out of the sea, or the Antichrist, the forces of Satan working through mankind, or if you like, one man in particular. And now he gets his deserts in these judgments, not only him, but his kingdom as well. And we find that men gnaw their tongues in anguish, and they have pain and sores. But once again, they don't repent of their evil deeds. I'm glossing over this fairly quickly because you'll find a lot of these things I'm talking about here are going to be dealt with when we get on into chapter 19, and you'll find it's more specific there what actually happens to the beast and his cohorts. The sixth bowl in verse 12 is poured out upon the river Euphrates. Now if you send your mind back once again to the sixth trumpet, it involved the river Euphrates, and we had those horse-like demons. Well, once again we have demons here, evil spirits. The water dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. Now in the previous case, it was evil spirits coming from this northern border, and now it's the Euphrates drying up to to make a ready highway for the nations that are going to gather together to fight and get their deserts. But more specifically in verse 13, we see issuing from the mouth of the dragon. The dragon, remember, is the one we saw in chapter 12, the seven heads and 10 horns, who was Satan. We are told that that was Satan. And from the mouth of the beast, that is the Antichrist, we saw in chapter 13. And from the mouth of the false prophet, that is the second beast of chapter 13, the trinity of evil. From all of these three creatures came foul spirits like frogs. In the trumpet judgments, we had the locust-like frogs and the horse-like frogs. Now we have, I beg your pardon, the locust-like demons, and then the horse-like demons, and now the frog-like demons. We are told in verse 14 that they are demonic spirits performing signs who go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for battle on the great day of God the Almighty. Which means, putting it into plain language, that the political leaders of the world are motivated through evil and selfishness and political ambition or whatever to declare war on each other. And so you have the sort of thing that's happened once again all through history. Wars taking place, going right back to the very first seal judgment back in chapter 5. War and bloodshed. But this one is the climactic war which results in God intervening in one great final judgment. Verse 15, his coming is unexpected. Lo, I am coming like a thief. We should always remember that, because most of the self-appointed prophets that we meet these days are trying to tell us when to expect the Lord's return, and they've got the date worked out, some of them, who are less wise than others. The Bible tells us that the Lord is coming at a time when we don't expect, not at a time when we do expect. He's coming when we don't expect it. So anybody that comes out with a date of the Lord's return, you can immediately dismiss him, because that is contrary to what the Bible teaches. The Lord is coming like a thief when you don't know. Blessed is he who is awake, keeping his garments, that he may not go naked and be seen exposed. Which is a warning to the Christians and a warning to us. Be ready. The Lord is coming when we don't expect. Therefore, we must always be ready. Otherwise, we're going to be ashamed when he comes. Almost literally, you could say you get caught with your pants down, because that's what it says here, that he may not go naked and be seen exposed. Which is fair enough. He said you're not to get caught when you're not ready. Make sure that you are ready at all times. So these people assemble themselves in verse 16 at a place which is called in the Hebrew Armageddon. It's the hill of Megiddo, or the city of Megiddo. And those of you who were here earlier in the year for my studies in the geography of Palestine will recall that Megiddo was the town on the side of the plain of Esdraelon in the northern part of Palestine, and that is where the majority of the wars in Israel were fought. Israel being a hilly country, it was difficult to find a good large place where you could have a decent fight, and that's where it happened, up near Megiddo. So in the symbolism of the book, that is the obvious place where these nations gather together. Once again, this is all vision, and it's talking to us of the final crisis which heads up things at the end of the world's history. I don't think we need take the hill of Megiddo literally. In fact, there is no hill of Megiddo that anybody knows of. But it's again drawing on the symbolism that people were familiar with. Just like we sometimes say he met his Waterloo, you know, because we're referring to a particular battle, or the spirit of Gallipoli or something like this. Or for the Israelites, just like we would refer to Gallipoli, or other people might refer to somebody getting his Waterloo, so the Israelites always referred to Megiddo. This is part of the system here in the general phraseology the person's using. I don't take that literally. In fact, the place is so small that you'd hardly fit any more than a few thousand soldiers on it to have a decent battle anyway, let alone people from every one of the several hundred nations in the world sending half a dozen regiments along. But we're not to look at the book in that way. This is God working through history, and he intervenes in final judgment. After this, in verse 17, the seventh angel poured his bowl into the air, and a great voice came out of the temple from the throne saying, "It is done." Now back in chapter 15, verse 8, we saw that the temple was forbidden. Nobody could go into the temple to ask God to postpone the judgment. And so we have straight through seven bowls poured out without any delay. And when it is finished, then you have the voice coming from the temple saying, "It is done." And as usual, there were in verse 18 flashes of lightning, loud noises and the like. You find at the conclusion of the seal judgments, the trumpet judgments and the bowl judgments, you have these flashes of lightning, loud noises and all the other sound effects that go with the final great judgment. Verse 19, the city was split into three parts, the cities of the nations fell, and God remembered great Babylon to make her drain the cup of the fury of his wrath. He's going to make Babylon drink the cup of his wrath. We'll see when we get into chapter 17 and into chapter 18 that Babylon is used as a symbol of mankind in his opposition to God. Civilization, you might say, as it develops, and man always uses his powers and his abilities to make himself independent of God and to fight against God. That really is the symbolism of Babylon, and it's developed extensively in chapter 17 and 18. You can go right back to the beginning of time, the beginning of creation, the beginning of human existence, and you find that man rebelled against God. I want to be like God, back in the Garden of Eden. Man is never content to be under God's authority. He always wants to be independent. And then you have the story in Genesis of the sons of God and the daughters of men wanting to create a super race, not content to be under God's control. The Tower of Babel again. Babel, of course, is ancient Babylon. We will make a name for ourselves. We, again, are going to use our advanced technology or our knowledge or our wisdom, our abilities, our collective abilities to form a society whereby we can exist for security and for mutual benefit, always in defiance of God. Now that is the way it's always been. You come along to Babylon in the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar, is not this great Babylon which I have built? That spirit is always there defying God, and God has to turn him out to eat grass like an animal. Now this is the way mankind is, even today. The more man progresses, the more he wants to use his newfound abilities and wisdom and economic power and political strength to create a world which makes him more self-sufficient and more able to live without reference to God. And it's one of the tragedies of human existence. And we see it, of course, very highly developed today with all the things man can do that he couldn't do even 20 years ago. But the problem is that man, when he gets this power and ability, instead of using it for God, always he uses it for his own glorification and to fight against God. That is what the New Testament calls the world. For all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, it's not of the Father, it's of the world. And the world lieth in the power of the evil one. Or Babylon, that's what Babylon is in this book as we're going to follow it through. We're going to now see the fall of Babylon. Pride being brought low. Which brings us to chapter 17, a very difficult chapter. Because in chapter 17 you find that Babylon is both a city and a woman. It starts off giving us the picture of a prostitute, and the prostitute is identified as Babylon. Human society organized independently of God and in opposition to God. Man opposed to God. If you can think of John in his time, it was of course the Roman Empire. It was the greatest thing that man had known in the way of a developed civilization to that time. Well, they thought it was anyway. But what do? They get their political power and then they use it to foster an anti-God rule, to develop an anti-God spirit. You find that blasphemies emerge, which are talked about here. The Roman emperors deifying themselves, wanting to be worshipped as God. Well, all this political maneuvering that's going on is likened to intercourse with a prostitute. This again is a very common figure in the Bible. Economic and political treaties between nations are frequently referred to under the imagery of intercourse with a prostitute. That is, it's a deal made between two people for the enjoyment, gratification, or profit of both parties, but without any thought for God's standards or for God's authority or for righteousness or purity. Now, this is what the nations of the world do. They've been doing it all through history, and you can see it very plainly today. The whole power game is a case of manipulating, making agreements, each for his own benefit, always to strengthen himself so that he might be able to live independently of God. Now, the prostitute, who typifies Babylon, or the world if you like, The prostitute is supported by Antichrist, because the prostitute is riding on the back of this beast, the beast that we saw in chapter 13, the beast with seven heads and ten horns. Just as you picture an ancient cavalryman going out to fight on his horse, and the horse carries him through and he can execute great deeds, so this woman executes great deeds because she's riding his beast. The picture is very plain, isn't it? Man is achieving all sorts of goals and he's getting great power. But what's he relying upon to do it? He's relying upon the power of Antichrist. The anti-Christian spirit always has been in the world, as we find in the epistles of John. And it's always there, working in some way or other. Which means that the forces of evil, man will appropriate these things to himself, simply to get his own way and to strengthen himself. Now you can see this if you want to think of in terms of the politics of the world in the United Nations, you can see it that way. If you want to come right down to the very suburban street you live in, I think we can see it even there. How that the more money we get, the more power we get, speaking generally of our society or any other society, what do people do? Do they give God glory? On the contrary, the more power people get, the higher they get in business, in education, in society or whatever. For the non-Christian, the more he gets, the more he uses that acquired economic or intellectual strength, the more he uses that to establish himself as a little god in his own empire where nobody is going to touch him, so that he becomes unconquerable, you might say. He becomes more and more independent of God. So what we have here is a picture of the whole world system that we as Christians live in. Now what we've got to do is make sure that we don't do the same sort of thing, because we live not by sight, but by faith. We don't live by the things we see and the amount that we can measure in terms of economic or any other strength that we have. We live in dependence upon God. If you only have to watch the TV commercials to see how everything is pandering to the self-gratification of man and saying to him, look, you can make yourself better, you can get better, and you can make yourself more and more secure and less exposed, less vulnerable to attack. And all the system that we build up, it's again Satan very subtly working so that man uses all that he has to fight against God. So the woman is riding on the beast, and the beast is carrying her along. All right, that's the opening section. We'll read it through. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come and I'll show you the judgment of the great harlot who is seated upon many waters. Many waters, later on in the chapter, is interpreted as meaning international, worldwide, everywhere. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. This is political leaders doing deals among one another. And with the wine of whose fornication the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And so power drunk is a very biblical sort of expression. He carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of blasphemous names. It had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was decked out in all sorts of finery there, just like a prostitute normally is, making herself look very attractive and gaudy. But verse 5, on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and the earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Telling us again that worldly man is opposed to godly man, and they're pleased to see the end of the Christians. Now the plot thickens as you come to verse 7. The angel explained to me, why do you marvel? And it's all right for him to say that, but we do marvel nevertheless and wonder what's going on. He says, I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with its seven heads and ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to perdition. Now that is an echo of what we saw in chapter 13 about this beast. It had seven heads. One of its heads received what appeared to be a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. It was aping Christ. Antichrist again copying Christ. You have life, death, and apparent resurrection. But the difference is, of course, that with Jesus Christ it was life, death, and resurrection, and then he lives forever. With Antichrist it's a case of life, apparent death, apparent resuscitation, but he goes into perdition. So that's the contrast there. But all of this causes people to marvel. Now if you can think in terms of the Roman Empire of John's day, they had very vivid illustrations right before their own eyes. You had Nero, for example, the great Nero, and the persecutions there. But then it all died down. and there was a period of calm, and Rome seemed to have lost its muscle for a little while, but then it revived again and came back with renewed force in the time of John here. That became a theory that people propounded in those days of Nero revived. You'll often hear this referred to, that Domitian was really Nero come back to life again. Now possibly there is an echo of that in this here, but I think there's more to it than that, because in any era, in any place, you'll find the persecution will be there very strong, and then it will die down, come back to life again. You get nations coming and nations going, and people marvel at how the chessboard changes. And we can marvel just in the last 5 years. China, what, 5 or 10 years ago was the big bad ogre, and now, of course, everybody's palsy-walsy with China. A few years ago, who would ever have thought that Egypt and Israel would be kissing each other? And now they are, but next year they may not be. So what we have here is this, that the scene among nations changes all the time, and it's very hard to keep track of. But as you come here, we find that the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, marvel to behold the beast. In other words, the non-Christian people are fascinated with all these comings and goings, but the Christian should know better, because his faith is in God, and he's not easily swayed. And let me say, a lot of Christians seem to be very, very easily swayed. You get the impression they read the newspaper each day just to find out something exciting about how bits and pieces of the great jigsaw puzzle of God's plan are going to fall into place with the nations of the world. They're chopping and changing, and they make prophecies and predictions, and within 2 years they're proved wrong, so they have another go and try something else. The people of the world, they may be fascinated, and they may be thrown this way and that, but the Christian must realize that these things happen anyway. This is just part of history. We realize that everything is under control of God, and we don't marvel the way the non-Christian does when nations rise and nations fall. That's why it is in verse 9 that this calls for a mind of wisdom. He goes on to say the seven heads are seven hills on which the woman is seated. So we get a bit more complicated here. The seven hills would speak of what, security and strength. So here this woman is very firmly in control. She has a great stability about her kingdom. It possibly is a reference to Rome, though I suspect that that's just a little bit too neat to fit. You know, Rome was built on seven hills, but I think that may be taken just a little too far. Verse 10 is the difficult verse, because here you get yet another meaning to the seven heads. This is about the third meaning we've had now. The seven heads are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. When he comes, he must remain only for a little while, and as for the beast, that's Antichrist, that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to perdition. Well, what do you make of all that? The seven heads are seven kings. Well, that's a start. It's a reference to either seven emperors or seven empires or something to do with manipulation of power. People have explained this in various ways. I'll give you a couple of suggestions. One is that it's referring to various emperors in the first century. However, you can never make them quite fit the scheme. Five have already passed, the sixth was reigning at present, and the seventh was yet to come. But no matter how much you count them, it's very difficult to fit the emperors in. A more likely suggestion is that it refers to seven empires which had oppressed God's people. And if you go back, you find, in fact, that does fit a little better, because you've got Egypt as the first great oppressor, then you've got Assyria, then you've got Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Rome is the sixth, which means five have gone before, Rome is the sixth, and there's one yet to come, which is the final great kingdom which gives rise to the dominion of Antichrist. That again strikes me as being a little too neat. It has a lot going for it. But I prefer to take this to mean simply that the end is approaching. No matter what era you live in, you can look back and you can say that this is history, we are here, and the future is not far in front of us. That is, the end is not far in front of us. The end is drawing near. And that seems to me to be the symbolism here. Because in any era, you read the book of Revelation, it is meaningful. That's another reason why I'm very skeptical of these people that find prophecies of bank card and all these odds and ends in the book of Revelation. Because if that was literally true, it means that the book has had no meaning for the last 20 centuries to all the people who lived in a more primitive economic system. What I'm saying is this: in any era, this book makes sense. And I've tried to point that out as we've gone along, that all these judgments are there in some form in any era. Christ could come in the 2nd century or the 5th century or the 10th or the 20th or the 25th or the 30th. We have no idea, we have no way of knowing which century. But all these elements are there at all times. Now we see developments today, don't we? We see developments in the economic system, in the political system, which appear to be heading towards the great climax. Well, I believe that's true. But it's always been heading towards that climax. It doesn't mean to say the climax is just around the corner. It may be another 2,000 years before that climax is reached. But if Jesus had have come in the first century, everything here in this book of Revelation would have fitted in with his coming in the 2nd century. Or if he had have come in the 15th century, or if he comes even now, you'll find it all fits together. It's just that the intensity is increasing all the time. It always appears to us that the end is just around the corner. Any generation of Christians may be the last generation of Christians to inhabit this earth, but we have no way of knowing. So always it looks as if 5 kingdoms have passed, we're in the 6th, and the last one is just in front of us. And the last one gives rise to the 8th beast here, who is Antichrist. It says he is of the 7. It doesn't say he is one of the 7. It says he is of the 7. He is one of the same type as they are. Which means that if you take the 7 as being 7 emperors, well, it means that the Antichrist is an emperor. Or if you take the 7 as being 7 empires, it means Antichrist is an empire. Now again, Antichrist, you can interpret Antichrist in terms of all the hideous people that have risen up and persecuted God's people. You can look for an Antichrist in one particular person who will rule worldwide at the end of the age. Or you can look upon Antichrist as the system of the world which is opposed to Jesus Christ. You won't get it tied down in the book of Revelation one way or the other. We can interpret this symbolism in various ways, although one would have to admit that the statement in 2 Thessalonians about the man of lawlessness does tend to point towards a single person rather than a system. But whatever it is, be it a system, an empire, or an emperor, it is still the incarnation of Satan. Satan at work in the society of men. Well, the plot thickens even more as you come to verse 12. Because the 10 horns are given another meaning now. They are 10 other kings who have not yet received royal power, so they don't belong to the Roman Empire or to any of these other empires we've been talking about. But they will receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast, which means they will have a brief time of glory. And in that time, in verse 13, they will be of one mind to give over their power and authority to the beast, and they'll make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those with him are called and chosen and faithful. So the picture then, again, I think here is a little simpler. It is simply a picture of nations of the world banding together, but again, giving themselves over to Satan. They're sold out to evil to fight against God and his purposes, and specifically against the people of God. As a result, you find that they make war on the Lamb, but the Lamb finally conquers them. So that's a frightfully difficult section, that chapter 17, from verse 7 through to verse 14. And if you can work it out any better than I've explained here, well, good luck to you. But if we can see it in terms of the manipulation of power for man to exalt himself, and particularly to use international power to form a grand society whereby he need not fear, and hopefully he can insulate himself against God. He wants to make himself independent of God, but in the end he brings about his own downfall. And that's what is described in the last few verses. You find these nations are united only briefly. They hate one another, they become jealous of each other, and soon divisions appear among them. They have given over their power to the beast, and the beast supports the woman. You got this picture again? There are so many meanings given to these different symbols of horns and heads and everything else here that it gets a bit complicated. But if you've got the picture here of the woman, Babylon, human society organized as self-sufficient and in opposition to God, using the power of Antichrist, that is, using ungodly powers to get its own way, in the end, it's destroyed by those very things that it used. The animal that it's riding to achieve its great dominion and power, just when that person, that woman, thinks she's got everything, suddenly the animal turns and eats her up. Now that is very, very up to date I'm sure that we can see that ourselves, that man gets cleverer and cleverer. The cleverer he gets, the more he is able to establish his economic and his political stability. He's able to do more and more things. We only have to think of the technology of our age, satellites and computers and goodness knows what not. But what man is doing all the time is not only making the world more secure for himself, he's also inventing the very things that are eventually going to destroy him. The obvious thing is nuclear weaponry, isn't it? And the whole nuclear power age that we live in. Man can achieve enormous things that he could never have achieved by more conventional methods. But at the same time, he invents the very things which eventually will destroy him. The woman Babylon rides the beast. She achieves everything she wants, and in the end, the beast devours her. Now, if that's not a warning to us, I don't know what else is. The Christian has to take stock of himself. He has to realize this is the world he lives in. Now, we can't opt out of it. There's no sense our saying we're not going to have anything to do with the new technology. You can't avoid it. This is the world we live in, for better or for worse. But what we are going to do is say, everything is going to be under the control of God, and we are not going to hand ourselves over to evil. We're not going to allow ourselves to be manipulated by ungodly principles. That's the way the world may go. The Christian operates from a different basis. That's the message that the chapter concludes on. He said to me, "The waters that you saw," back in verse 1 and verse 2, where the harlot is seated, "are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the harlot. They'll make her desolate and naked. They'll devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and giving over their royal power to the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city which has dominion over the kings of the earth." Now in chapter 18, we're going to see how that great city is destroyed, how Babylon is destroyed. And that's our starting point for next week. But just going back to the point I made a moment ago about all these things being true of any era of the world's history. Now, we today think in terms of the world as we know it, the United Nations and all the international treaties and the different groups in the Commonwealth and the non-aligned nations or the Western powers. And we say this is all heading up towards the great climax. But even in the first century, the same things were there. It was the Roman Empire. Now, we today, with our global knowledge, look upon the Roman Empire as a fairly small thing, just a few nations in Europe and Western Asia. They didn't even take into consideration Australia or South America or some of these more important parts of the world. But even if it had have happened there, in their terms of reference, it still would have been fulfilled. So that's what I'm saying, that in any era, be it 1st century, 5th century, 20th century, or 37th century, for all we know, all the elements are there, politically and in every other way, they're all there. They're the working of Satan. Christ could come. We simply cannot interpret events so literally and so minutely and exactly to forecast the day. But all the elements have always been there. Any generation of Christians could be the last generation of Christians. It could be us. And that's why it is that the writer constantly comes back to the point, keep your garments white, keep yourselves spotless, keep yourselves ready, because the Son of Man is coming as a thief. He's coming in an hour that you don't expect.